Welcome to Built in the Bluegrass, a podcast dedicated to cool stuff made in Kentucky. We want to share with you how it was made, why it was made, and the story behind it. And now, here's your host.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Built in the Bluegrass. We're really excited today because I do think that this will be a very interesting, I don't know if it's controversial, but it's certainly dynamic in what we're going to be discussing and the options, the competition, the market forces behind it, whether they be government or otherwise. But numerous things that I think are worth discussing today that are going to be coming to us from Mick Henderson from we'll talk a little bit about this, but I believe it's Commonwealth Agri-Energy, as well as Kentucky Ethanol, as well as many other plethora of names. We'll let him go into a little bit of that, but I want to first just get started, say welcome, Mick. And if you would, just give us a little background so we get started to get the discussion going of, you know, who you are, what it is you do, you know, why ethanol, why other things besides ethanol within, you know, your company. Just tell us a little bit of the background of why you exist.
Okay. Well, hey, Griffin. I'm Mick Henderson, General Manager of Commonwealth Agri-Energy, where we process Kentucky corn into value-added products that are sold not only in the Commonwealth, but in the Southeast. The most, the main product would be fuel ethanol. And that mostly goes to the Nashville Metro, which Nashville Metro ends up being back into Kentucky for 10% gas. 10% of every gallon of gas sold, not only in Nashville area, but from Hopkinsville to Bowling Green to all over the middle and western Kentucky from our main customer terminals in Nashville.
So let me interrupt you and say, when you say 10%, you don't mean 10% of each gallon of gas that comes out. You mean you represent a 10% market share, not that 10% of ethanol goes into gasoline, correct?
10% of all the gas sold in America is ethanol.
Got it. But it's not a combination of the two, and it's just...
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. We are an ingredient in your gasoline, where the octane in your gasoline. You go to the pump and you fill up with 87 octane. 10% of that is 113 octane ethanol, which boosts the 84 octane of the gasoline blend stock up to 87. So we provide the octane, which is the power in the gallon of gas. And it's also the oxygenate that provides lower tailpipe emissions in your auto's exhaust. So that's the main reason for being here, because when I say we process Kentucky corn, we are we're processing the local corn grown in Christian County. In fact, our supply is probably from a 5-county adjacent area where we're able to convert 45,000 bushels a day or 15 million bushels a year of Kentucky corn into ethanol and other products. But that is our ownership. We're an LLC that's 100% owned by the Hopkinsville Elevator Cooperative, which is 3,500 members, not just Kentucky, but especially Kentucky, that are mostly nearby, that we sell, we buy their grain to process into those value-added products. Fuel ethanol being the original reason for starting up in March of 2004, about half the size we are now. We're about 48 million gallons a year now. And catching an order of magnitude, that's about 1/3 of the ethanol required at 10% of all the gasoline in our region. Okay?
In which region? Defined region?
That's Nashville, Middle Tennessee, Western Kentucky, even Central Kentucky. So wherever those terminals supply.
And that's all produced out of your shop right there in Hopkinsville.
Yeah. And I've said that about 5 times now, that that's our main product. But actually, the kernel of corn is fiber, protein, fats, starches. The starch portion of the kernel 2/3 of the kernel, is cooked and fermented, and then that product ethanol is distilled into ethanol. So about 1/3 of the bushel ends up as ethanol. 1/3 of the bushel ends up as carbon dioxide. When I say fermented, when yeast produces ethanol or alcohol, it produces for every pound of ethanol, it produces a pound of CO2. We have a CO2 plant next door, air gas, that processes it into liquid CO2 and dry ice for regional users, carbonated beverages, packing plants for dry ice for freezer trucks. So 1/3, 1/3. The last third is distillers dried grains. The number one commodity in Kentucky isn't thoroughbred horses, it's poultry. We feed 10% of every ration at the chicken houses in the region is going to be distillers dried grains. We're kind of a mid protein, three times the protein of corn, about half the protein of soybean meal. And that's 1/3 of every bushel ends up as chicken feed. It can also be cattle feed. It can also be hog feed. We're not really much into the horse or pet food market, but we are definitely in poultry nearby. And so when you process 45,000 bushels a day of corn, it's like 45 big truckloads. You get 15 truckloads of ethanol. You get 15 truckloads of CO2. That's across the pens, and they make it into liquid CO2 or dry ice. And 15 truckloads of distillers dried grains every day.
Well, so unpack that for me a little bit. So I don't just smash the kernel with a hammer and 1/3 of it goes here and 1/3 of it goes there, 1/3 of it goes there. There's a reasoning for each particle that has to be put into each of those subcategories, right? How is that done? And you know, what is it that's done in your plant that makes that, you know, the end product? Well, maybe not the end product, but the end product for leaving your facility.
The fun way is to compare it, contrast it ultimately, but compare it to your typical bourbon distillery in the bluegrass. When you've got corn as your main ingredient, maybe you'll have a little rye or barley, you'll have a process to make into bourbon, very similar to what you'll make into fuel ethanol. From start to finish, you grind it, you cook it, you ferment it, you distill the alcohol, and then you process the leftovers or the other products that don't go out as ethanol into those other streams. And that, what you're saying, those particles are separated in a cook and a fermentation and a distillation process that allows you those three, four, we actually have five, six, maybe even seven products to come out of our plant today.
Cool. So you're basically heating it and some sort of no real chemical addition.
There's a protease enzymatic sort of catalyst that you'll add. Same thing as the proteins, enzymes in your digestive tract. The yeast kind of has to use the same sort of thing, breaks down starches into sugars that they can eat. That's the same thing your body does. So when the yeast eats sugar, this is corn sugar that was corn starch, it makes ethanol as its main product, CO2 and ethanol in equal parts.
So talk to me about the, so you mentioned about the, back to the gas and, you know, the ethanol portion. You know, how come, you know, why don't I pull up to the gas pump and I see, you know, a complete ethanol, you know, pumping option? I see diesel, I see 87, I see 93. You know, how come is it cost prohibitive? What is your value? You know, oil isn't the most stable market out there. I mean, just look at what's happening right now with the cyber attack that happened, not to mention problems that go on in the Middle East. So how come you can't find a value proposition where it's an entire ethanol, you know, system, well, gas system?
Yeah, they're historical as well as technical issues today that developed from 100 years ago. If you said the first Model T, how was it built? If you've heard of the term flex fuel vehicle, the first flex fuel vehicle was probably a Model T Ford, because in the agrarian society that we lived 100 years ago, or at least our great grandparents lived in, you could grow your own fuel. So the original Model T, the expectation was it would run on ethanol. And oil was struck in Pennsylvania, previous century, late century, and a guy by the name of Rockefeller was a teetotaler. He helped get the prohibition, if you recall your history, 1920s, 1930s, prohibition to include fuel ethanol into the drinkable ethanol. There's really not a whole lot of difference, matter of impurities and flavors, but we were prohibited from manufacturing agrarian agricultural crops into fuels because the petroleum industry really didn't want the competition. So until the, again, probably your history books, I can remember in grade school, the Gulf War, the oil embargoes of Jimmy Carter's administration, that was our first chance back into the fuel supply. We needed an alternative to OPEC. We needed an alternative to oil running the world. It wasn't a big portion for a long time. Really not about the time this plant was built, 2003, 2004, we came on stream about the time the big ramp up of ethanol was deregulated to the point where, you know, prohibition of drinking alcohol, that was only for what, 10 years, 15 years? Fuel ethanol was put behind the eight ball, behind fuel, petroleum fuels for another 70 years. So early 2000s, we started providing a 10% ethanol because of the need for an oxygenate. That's a need for a way of reducing tailpipe emissions. And that's where we got our foot in the door. And then, you know, oil companies are not fools. If they can use that to better crack their products, they can make a lower octane gasoline, because ethanol being naturally higher octane, they can make all the money.
So there's definitely a sense of nationalism that's probably about to happen, you know, over what's happened the last year and certain things with, you know, I think everybody had a realization of what's happened over the last year and how much you're dependent on other countries. And not that the United States doesn't produce a certain amount of oil, and I'm not going to get into those numbers right now, but so what is, does ethanol not have a value proposition? And that's not just me being a Kentuckian and thinking, hey, let's take care of our natural resources and get them out there. But is there not a position that you could put it in to make it more of a ongoing, sustainable, or is it cost prohibitive? What's keeping me from doing this? Or what's keeping, besides these old laws, what today prevents you from putting a product out there that fuels a car the same as, you know, an oil-powered gasoline?
Yeah, very little. In fact, in the flex fuel vehicle evolution, it got to be where it was a software change, where fuel injected engines made it very easy to adjust the air to fuel ratio in an engine to optimize according to how much ethanol is in the fuel. That's where the flex fuel can run from E0 to E85, 85% ethanol to fuel a vehicle. Now the way they build them, they don't necessarily optimize for mileage. So I disagree with some of the use of flex fuel, because we end up having to compete with a lower mileage vehicle when it's E85 versus E0 or E10. But we have always been very competitive. It ends up being a lobbying regulatory environment that petroleum has always had the upper hand. I like to say we compete with the wealthiest industry in the history of mankind. It's kind of hard when deeper pockets can always win. But the corn lobby is not bad, okay? The corn farmer lobby in Midwestern states is not bad. They know where to put their money and don't have to fight it dollar for dollar. And we, of course, feel like right is on our side. We have the American-made fuel. We have the agricultural-based fuel. We have a renewable fuel that can compete straight up with price and value of any petroleum-made fuel. And like, so what keeps us out of the market? Well, deep pockets. What keeps us out of the market? An industry that got there first. So when we have to try to sell our ethanol through the same retail stations that are franchised or otherwise with controlled by the petroleum fathers, Seven Sisters, or whatever you want to call them these days, we have a hard time getting in the tank. So let's say we won a few times, we've won a lot recently, and we look like we are absolutely on a trajectory that's, we should build more plants, we should make more, we should grow more corn. Along come a little guy out there in California that reinvented the electric vehicle. And I think Arnold Schwarzenegger was maybe the first governor that said, we're going to have 20% EVs by 2020. You realize that didn't happen, but it's the petroleum's done a good job of this too. Put something that's not there yet in the forefront of where everyone should be. And then you have someone like GM that says, we're going to stop building internal combustion engines after 2035. Now, a lot of that's political. Okay. You can have the latest administration says we're going to convert everybody to EV and the whole world's going to be kumbaya, no more fossil fuel. Now, no more fossil fuel required. We fit in the middle. In fact, if you really study the cradle to grave or mine to full life cycle of a vehicle, we compete straight up with EVs. Not petroleum necessarily, not as a component of petroleum, but ethanol itself can have a low carbon footprint if that's the world that we want to live in. And that's the latest dog and pony show that's working in Washington, D.C.
So you mentioned electric vehicles. I didn't hear you mention anything about natural gas. You know, so we've talked about OPEC. You talk about, you know, what Tesla's doing with batteries. You know, where do you, and you, you know, we know where, you know, some of the new things such as natural gas, you know, how do you, in 10 years, where do you see ethanol? Bigger footprint, smaller footprint? How do you compare to those products? You know, I
assume the Trump administration 2 years ago, May 2019, maybe it was 2018, broke some of the regulations down that were, again, simply there to keep us out of the market and allowed E15 year round. That's 15% ethanol, not E85 because that's 15% gasoline, but 15% ethanol instead of 10% ethanol year round. There was a summertime limit on 15% ethanol that was just a regulatory fabrication. We got that eliminated. By the way, we're now fighting a lawsuit that oil companies have said that was illegal. EPA didn't have the authority to do that. But for today, we stand with a 50% increase in our market share. We could go from 10% ethanol in all vehicles in the U.S. today, all gasoline sold to vehicles today as regular, we could go to E15. That's like my plant getting to be 50% bigger.
Do you have to scratch? Who's all back? Do you got to scratch to get that actually into fruition? I know that you have, you know, the regulatory piece that, you know, you talked about getting rid of, but what about the other piece, which is, you know, the petroleum industry as a whole, the gas stations, the stakeholders that have been around forever? How much back scratching you got to do there to get it from 10 to 15?
The gas petroleum producers / refiners would say internal combustion fuel suppliers better partner up. You better join with us or these EV boys are going to stomp us. I heard that directly from not to be named oil refiner. And then you've got the EV saying you might be greener than petroleum products, but you're not as green as us. You better help us stomp those refiners or we'll burn you too. But yeah, we're in the middle. We serve both. You know, our real customer isn't the consumer at the pump. Our customer is that infrastructure that supplies liquid fuels at the pumps. And guess who those guys are? Guess who they're most beholden to?
The status quo, the way things have always been.
You don't want to stab your customer in the back as you try to say you're better than they are to somehow get market share. So we got to walk that line. And then, of course, the EVs. So I've seen lately in a ramification that stationary sources might be a good use for ethanol. Consider the, if you've seen the EV that's disabled alongside the vehicle, alongside the road, out of power, and being recharged by a gasoline-powered pickup truck pulling a diesel-powered generator to refuel that EV that's sitting alongside the road. You think about that for a minute. So there are lots of standby generation capacity in the country. Think of every hospital that's got a generator on site, diesel-powered generator on site for emergency backup power. You could convert that to ethanol. You could have your battery, so to speak, consider the grid. We're going to have these windmills and solar panels to power the grid. What about peak? What about offline? What about when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine? So is that gas turbines versus coal or whatever? So it could be ethanol. You could have ethanol in tanks, just like you have diesel in tanks as those emergency generators. So maybe our future, if EVs are absolutely, hands down, the better choice, kind of like cars that displaced horses, and EVs are going to displace internal combustion engines, maybe we find our future. I'm going to go 10, 15 years down the road, 25 years down the road, to be stationary sources that keep those EVs powered up. If you want to be in a non-petroleum world.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, in the nationalism I was speaking of earlier, that means you produce it here locally. You make the batteries, when I say locally, meaning the United States. Whenever you're talking about what do you really have to have, it's corn, not oil. So it's not, it's renewable, it's cleaner. And if the way it sounds, it doesn't sound like you think, you know, electric vehicles are going to be gone tomorrow. So you fully anticipate that being a wave of the future that's going to hold on, even coming from the, you know, the industry that you're in.
I think you better be ready. You know, you don't want to go the way of the saddle, if you know what I mean. You don't want to be the guy that makes horseshoes when everybody starts driving cars. Corn is the best. Now, I'm probably biased, but the row crop plant that fits North American Midwest better than any other crop. Okay? So process that crop into products. So if you said, what do you really do, Mick? Well, I'm a corn processor. You could say I could be a wheat processor or a soybean processor or a sorghum processor, but the number one crop in the nation is corn, and I can make it into value-added products. And so a fuel ethanol carries your water, okay? I can make a lot of ethanol, fuel ethanol. If we need protein, the world is short on protein. Soybeans are, you know, four times more protein per kernel than corn, but protein still is, you know, 9% protein in the kernel. That's getting a lot of value these days. Shoot, what's even bigger in renewable fuels than ethanol is biodiesel. There is 3% of the kernel. Is that right? 3% of the kernel is fat, and the germ portion of the kernel, there's fat content. We already extract it. We sell it as an animal feed fat. It's part of that distiller's grain, one third of that bushel, is fractioning it out again as corn oil, distiller's corn oil. And we actually have biodiesel processors that buy our distiller's corn oil. And that's been a real value in the market today as well. So CO2, protein, corn, corn meal, corn oil that can be fuel or animal feeds, we actually can fractionate the fuel ethanol itself into higher purity ethanols and sell it as a whole list of products.
So all these products you're talking about, including ethanol, like if you were to take the production that we have today, could you do all these things independently? Like, could you have ethanol driving every road of, you know, in every vehicle, or supporting the system that we have today with the raw material, i.e. corn, that you have? Or is it just it could only supplement?
Well, you know, if you said when you first started this plant make in 2004, what were you doing? We've doubled the size of our plant. They've doubled the amount of yield per acre. We've doubled the gasoline slash liquid fuels demand in our region. So you're going to double again? Look at the genetics they're doing with seed corn today. And when it went from 100 bushel the acre to 200 bushel the acre, it's going to go to 300 bushel the acre. Not even more acres planted, more bushels to the acre. That technology, we're soaking it up. And then with efficiencies, what we've done in the last 18 years has also improved our energy efficiencies to compete with petroleum or other EVs now. You have not only an energy efficiency that just means lower cost to produce, but we actually, when we expanded the plant 3 years ago, we had to fulfill the obligations of a federal permit. It's called the EP3, Efficient Producer Pathway Permit. We had to be 20% lower carbon score than petroleum to even expand our plant. That was a contrived regulation that made us build the plant more efficient just for our carbon footprint. We did that. We doubled our plant size. I think more of that will happen. Again, I'm all about technology. I think the technology of the molecule ethanol, the seed corn that becomes field corn, that is a feedstock, a raw material for lots of products. We will be plugged into that and doing that here locally. And that's got a future. There may not be a future for it in places where it shouldn't be grown. I was in Western Nebraska, Western Kansas. The only thing green was the crop circles where they're irrigating. They're doing okay today, but there's plenty of rain in Kentucky and there's plenty of corn that can be grown where it's grown today. And they'll grow more.
So let's get processed nearby. Yeah. So let's shift gears and talk a little bit about the benefits of being where you are. So, you know, you're obviously some aspect of, you mentioned Hopkinsville Elevator, which is a good size co-op, you know, in your region. Why is Commonwealth Agri Energy or the production facility that you have, why is it in Western Kentucky? Why isn't it in Iowa? Why isn't it in, you know, Southeast Illinois? Why isn't it somewhere else? Like, what makes your company tick where it is? People, geographic location, cost of living, you know, it could be taxes. It could be the business climate in Kentucky versus other states. You know, you're down by several states all at the, you know, one location. So tell us a little bit about why it works where you are.
There are 200 some odd fuel ethanol plants in the Midwest. And Western Kentucky fits that, fits the description for locally grown corn.
So is that 200 your size?
Yes.
So there's 200 your size or bigger, yeah, in the, whatever, yeah, you described as Midwest. Okay.
But when I say there's 10% of the fuel supply, you got to come up with, right now it's about 135, 140 billion gallons of gasoline is the U.S. demand today. And we can produce about 16.5 billion gallons in the U.S. 10% is exported. Well, that gets you down around 15. Depends on the season and where, but we're 10% of the gasoline supply. So that's mostly in the Midwest, but in Western Kentucky, anywhere from I-65 all the way to the Mississippi River, a lot of corn is grown. Corn, beans, wheat, row crop region. And Christian County, Hopkinsville's county, is usually number one or number two in corn production every year. So where are you going to site a plant if you're going to site it anywhere in the corn belt of Western Kentucky? Hopkinsville, Kentucky is where you site it. And in fact, this particular site, Caskey Branch of the Hopkinsville Elevator, is built, I always like this story, on a quarry, rock quarry, where you can't grow corn. it's an old rock quarry that adjacent to the CSX main line, where they can ship corn out very efficiently. So it ended up being a, they bought it in 1994 and they started building grain bins and bringing the corn to this centrally located site to put it on unit trains. That'd be at the time, 65 car unit trains. Now it's 90 car trains. These are all hopper bottom rail cars that are only corn in the entire train. Okay. And they ship it out of here. That improved their basis a little bit, but for the most part, to process it is the even better idea right here on this site, the number one best site to deliver, the number one best site to process. So it's located, we're about a mile and a half south of downtown Hopkinsville. And it's an industrial region. This whole US 41 region is got a good manufacturing base to where you have good employee opportunities. You know what I'm saying? They have a skill set, whether it's a maintenance tech or operations. There's a lot of electronics, electricity training and or use that you have. Fits this manufacturing neighborhood. And being 75 miles from Nashville, there's your market for your fuel ethanol. For the poultry being the number one commodity in Kentucky, you have a ready-made local market for your animal feeds. And of course, the CO2 is across the fence, and that's going in the region as well, because we have a big bottling and processing of poultry where they use the dry ice. So our logistics, as you might compare to an Iowa ethanol plant, are actually better. There's not enough people that live in Iowa to use their products locally. We get to be a origination plant, which means our plant is adjacent and nearby to the raw material supply. And then we have the luxury of also being a destination market. We're close to our customers. And that competes with about anybody in the country.
So it's not, you know, not to use the farm to table example, you're talking farm to product from your local utilization is, hell, there's not any middlemen. You know, it is, you're taking it from the farmers to you. I guess you're this close to the middleman, producing it to each thing. Some of it's used locally, some of it's shipped off on a train. But logistically, you're saying it is absolutely perfect. And then your own utilization is, you know, an added plus to everything that you're able to get out from a productivity stance.
That's right. You got to compete still. You're not competing just with other fuel ethanol plants around the country. You're competing with petroleum. If you can't make it cost effectively, they'll figure out a way not to use you. And the same thing in the animal feeds. We distillers dried grains follows the corn price pretty closely. But if soybeans are the, let's say soybean oil going to biodiesel drives the soybean crusher, that means a soybean meal, which is a double the protein of our protein feed, drives that price down because they'll switch. Your customers will switch to other suppliers based on value. So you got to be, we feel like we make a superior distiller's grain. We run a low temperature dryer that makes a golden distillers, maintains the free amino acids better than others, better than the beverage distillers in our region. But we think we're very competitive in animal feeds. We're very competitive in the logistics of fuels that need to be transported to Nashville. You know, you mentioned that about the cyber attack that's hurting the Colonial Pipeline, mm-hmm. and that supplies these markets. And we'll probably see a spike in the next couple of weeks on gasoline. And our trade association put out a press release this morning. You can use a higher percentage of ethanol and alleviate some of those concerns with not having enough gasoline. Just take some of the regulations down. Last time something like this happened, if you remember, it was during Governor Bevin's term. There was a rupture on an Alabama pipeline, And instead of using more ethanol, they used less because they relieved the regulatory requirements to use ethanol so they could reroute, use the diesel line in different ways. I expect that'll happen here again. Someone will cry wolf, mostly. Someone will cry for help in the petroleum industry because of that Colonial Pipeline being down to bypass some normal regulatory issues like weights on trucks or some other rail car, maybe a train car, sort of reduce my regulations because we need to get that fuel to market. We're sitting over saying, well, use us. And they'll say, no, we need to use less ethanol. We need to lower that regulatory requirement because we need to supply that customer with gas. That's already happened to us. I really expect that more to happen than truly to go to E15 or E20 or E30 in the blend because we're here available. There's a huge ethanol plant in Georgia, been shut down for a year. They could power up in a matter of weeks if they just open the spigot.
Well, so we need to start wrapping up here, and I want to get to, you know, one last question. But so it seems that the Midwestern states are people that are producing this product. I mean, and again, in the sense of nationalism that we're going to experience in some capacity, why aren't they pushing for this? You know, why wouldn't they push for less dependence on foreign products, less dependence on those crazy amounts of pipelines that take to get product from wherever it is to, you know, why isn't there a local feeling towards this or a, you know, I'm sure there's a federal regulation. I don't want to get into that right now, but you know, why each state can't do their own thing when it comes to, you know, our, you know, local distribution. So how come, or will there be more of a push for local product in your field?
I think there is, and sometimes it's not the highlight of the headline of the local news. It's not the headline of the national news, but trying to get to those that make those decisions, the new administration, USDA and EPA, both were in the Midwest this last week talking to visit an ethanol plant in Nebraska to make sure they didn't miss what we can do for the country. And at least in my industry, it's playing. We know where we stand. We know where we need we know what we need to get through to the decision makers. And that's maybe where it costs money. Money better spent than doing a got milk campaign. You know what I'm saying? We don't have the money to do a got milk campaign. We do know who to talk to that make decisions on regulatory relief or let's just say playing fair.
Well, and it sounds like there's a strong position for just the value play. You know, then that's,
you'd be surprised how little that matters in the governmental world.
Yeah. But it matters a lot in the free market system of, hey, look what we make, look what is affecting our community, and then throw in the fact that it's a value play. So yeah. To wrap up here, Mick, just tell us a couple things we always want to ask. Like, you know, we haven't talked about some things that I'm sure you wanted to talk about today. You know, we try to keep this in a manageable time frame so that people don't look and say, ooh, 1 hour of ethanol. Let's move on to the next thing to listen to. Yeah. So tell us one thing about your business or a couple things, just, you know, as briefly as possible that you wish more people knew. I mean, I know you've talked a lot about that right now, but, you know, maybe I've asked all the perfect questions. I doubt I have. So tell us one thing that you wish more people knew or something about your industry. You want to get the word out. And then also we want to just get your contact information, which we'll do that here momentarily. So,
okay. Well, what we've been working on this last year, it really came to the forefront last March with COVID. Have you used hand sanitizer in the last week? Have you used more hand sanitizer in the last year than you ever used in your life?
Yes.
The main ingredient in hand sanitizer is ethanol. In fact, 60% ethanol in hand sanitizer from previous to COVID. The WHO formula required us to make 80%, just in case somebody didn't know what they're doing. But it's a disinfectant. It's a sanitizer. It's easily available for people that can't get to a sink to wash your hands.
And it's made from corn, which doesn't scare people.
Yeah, that's right. it does scare people when it's made in Mexico or made in China with ingredients that are dangerous. And that hurt us last summer. But we continued to supply, and that's a great story that took me half an hour to tell you, so I won't. But we were able to improve our quality to where even last August, we were making U.S. pharmaceutica grade, USP grade. We got our GMP program installed in the fall. We have added equipment to the plant. We've invested a couple million dollars. We're going to invest a couple million dollars more, and we're going to double our capacity. We're going to go to full grain neutral spirits. And if you're wondering what that is, it's basically 190 proof vodka quality. And we intend on marketing that in the region. Not only the hand sanitizer customers, manufacturers, but the full spectrum of industrial and beverage uses. And that's probably 20 different types of customers. But when I say vodka quality, I mean vodka quality. You have to be very low impurities to compete in that market. Not when there wasn't enough to go around last summer, but today it's back to a very competitive, low cost wins sort of market. And we intend to get there. We're building a still right now that by 1st of August, will be at 10 million gallons a year of best-in-class grain-neutral spirits, basically vodka quality.
So the takeaway from the listeners out there is expansion of what you're doing. You know, I mean, when you say vodka quality, I assume that means you could drink it if you wanted to. So expansion of, you know, what it is that, you know, I don't want to oversimplify, but it goes from corn to usable products. And that's, you know, what we wanted to discuss today. So, all right, Mick, to wrap up here, tell us how we can get a hold of you. Tell us your website, email address. If anybody wants to do business with Kentucky Ethanol Plants, how would they get in touch?
Well, CommonwealthAgriEnergy.com. All one word, no spaces, no hyphens. CommonwealthAgriEnergy.com is our website. mhenderson@kyethanol.com is my email contact. That's all on the website. And our marketer will also be there, so I don't have to go into those details. You get to the website, you get everything you need. If not, do a Google search on Kentucky Ethanol and we'll pop up.
Good deal. All right, guys. Thanks for another episode of Built in the Bluegrass. This has been very interesting. I think this is a very good topic and probably one of those that I want to do a follow-up to, just to get into more detail that talks about this specific thing, because if it's such a player in Kentucky, you know, we're having to do this with bourbon too, where there's so many people that have different things that can affect bourbon and how it's done. And, you know, this is something that is unique to our area that needs to be talked about. I mean, it's something that can be used more efficiently. So that's all for now. I'm Griffin Meredith, host of Built in the Bluegrass, and signing off for the day. Thank you, Mick Henderson. Talk soon.
Take care, Griffin.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Built in the Bluegrass. We hope you're leaving this episode with a better understanding of the cool stuff made in Kentucky. If you haven't done so already, make sure you're subscribed to the show. This way you'll get notified as new episodes become available. Until next time.